to a very, very important meeting in terms of recent political events. We've got Dave Sewell, a journalist for Socialist Worker, who's going to talk about 25 minutes on, is there a left-wing case for leaving the EU? And we've got lots of reports back and news about activities is all coming up later. So I'll just pass over straight to Dave. Thank you.
Well, I think one of the things that's been interesting with this referendum, and I think has made it difficult for a lot of people, is that the debate is essentially about anything but the EU. I mean, you see a bit of Nigel Farage, a bit of the Labour Party. In general, the debate, as we've seen it, is mainly between Tories against Tories. And, you know, people who've spent the past 10 years working together, doing the exact same thing, suddenly calling each other liars and saying they don't have a clue what's going on, which would be interesting to see how they work together again after all this, with all that. But that's all been very surreal. And then the debates, as it's been done, I think have mainly revolved around a set of myths, if you like, not just in the sense of things that aren't true, but sort of grand narratives that are very disconnected from the reality of how the EU works. And I'm going to argue that we do need to look directly in the eye at how the EU functions, what it does and what it's composed of. But I'm also going to talk about some of the things that detract for that. The truth is, I think if we made it about the EU, most people on the left wouldn't have a problem with saying we're against this sort of thing. I mean, if you look at what the EU has done in Greece, where it is essentially two parts of what's called the Troika, the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and the International Monetary Fund, that have been managing Greece's bailout and using it for the past 5 years to extort blackmail on successive Greek governments, demanding ever more and ever deeper cuts. When there was a government that was elected and said it was going to break with that, they responded by turning off the cash machines. And, you know, of course, there may have been ways that there were ways that government, we'd argue, could fight back. But nevertheless, it was quite staggering, the amount of force that the EU brought to bear on the Greek government in order to force through austerity. That's something that continues today. That's something that's been paralleled to some extent or other in a number of EU countries, actually continuing in Ireland, the negotiations over a new Irish government. One of the things that led to left-wing votes at the recent election was hatred of the water charges. So even right-wing parties are thinking, if we're going to form a government at all, maybe we need to get rid of these. The EU is saying they can't do that. I think if you look at the migrant crisis, the refugee crisis, whatever you want to call it, in the Mediterranean and the Aegean Seas, I think the case becomes even more compelling. Really, people may have seen the photo of the first deportation of refugees who'd made it across to the Greek islands back into Turkey, where it was these people under guard being dragged somewhere against their will, and the guards on their armbands, they had the blue flag with the gold stars. The reality is the border controls that have been put up in the Mediterranean are directly responsible for people having to risk their lives on the sea. And they're directly coming from EU directives. I mean, it's not very long ago, actually, as late as the 1980s, Italy, for example, had no immigration controls at all. It's a country people emigrated from. If someone actually came in, they were welcome from it. EU integration meant the demand that southern European countries start policing their external borders so that people couldn't come through there to countries like Germany and Britain and France. So the EU is, for example, demanded the Greek government build a wall on its border with Turkey. And, you know, it used to be a minefield along this wall. That was taken down, and that was, I think, something most people would see as that's progress. You know, that's good that there's no longer mines along that border. But it wasn't open for very long in historical terms. And in the past decade, the EU has had a wall built that's tens of thousands of tons of concrete, hundreds of kilometres of razor wire and barbed wire, a staff of guards that, you know, they have to spend more on paying them than they would on keeping a number of schools open, for example. You know, this huge thing. So that means people can't go across by land. There is the easiest thing to do if you're going to go from one country to another in a modern age would be to get a plane. People can't get a plane into Europe without a visa because of a European Union directive. And so that left people where the majority of refugees coming into Europe were going from the Aegean Sea, from Greece to Turkey. Now that's deadly enough. Several thousand people died there last year trying to do that. But actually since then, we've had an operation whereby Greece has been told that if it doesn't stop people getting in this way, Greece could be kicked out of the EU's internal border structure. And then border guards have been drafted in by the EU's border control body Frontex from all different European countries to come and police those islands. And if you see, you know, if you look at the video clips of someone doing it, of a police officer arresting some of the newly arrived refugees, it won't be the Greek word on their back, it will say polizei or whatever, they will have been drafted in from another country to do it. And then the EU promising to start deportations to Turkey, a deal that's very much pushed by David Cameron, by the way. That has driven more people to start going from Libya to Italy, or from Egypt to Italy. And these are far, far longer routes. You know, you can get from Turkey to a Greek island in 8 kilometres by sea. It's dangerous, but so that's one thing. To get from Egypt to Italy is 2,000 kilometres. And already this year alone, 2,000 people have drowned on that route. I think this is utterly monstrous. And I think when you look at the people being herded into detention camps en masse based on their nationality in Europe in the 21st century, that's something very chilling indeed. And while all the national governments have a role in that, this is the EU rolling that out. I think most people on the left have got to say you're against that. And I think then if you look at just a few other examples of what's happening in Ukraine, where the EU and Russia are in quite a grubby struggle for influence, really, each using local proxies to try and get the country more aligned to one or the other, that's fueled up what at its height was really a civil war, and several thousand people have been killed there, mainly by either fascist militia or armed rebels aligned to one superpower or another. That's the sort of thing that a socialist job to come out against, absolutely. And then when you look at how the EU functions in its you know, in its constitution and its setup, it's about as undemocratic an institution as you could get. It's impossible to vote for the European Commission, which is its leadership body. One thing that you sometimes get pointed to by people saying we should vote Remain is votes in the European Parliament. But they have no power whatsoever. They could vote for anything. It's not going to happen. Actually, they can't vote for anything. They have to get it cleared by the Commission first. But even if they voted for something, it doesn't mean it's going to happen. And then there are some of the original founding treaty measures that are effectively its constitution ban things like renationalising industries that are currently public. If someone's already nationalised, you can keep it there, but you can't bring it back. Competition measures that mean, for example, if you have workers who are employed by a company in one EU country working in another, it's up to the bosses which country's labour laws they use, and therefore you can employ people on worse conditions than the law of the country they're in, and you can you can take anti-strike measures if the union's campaign around that. You can rule out state aid to certain industries, as was the case with the Belgian steel industry went to the EC. All these measures, they're not part of a sort of law that can be amended by the European Parliament. They're part of treaties that were signed by all the states. And the only way they could be changed at all would be if every single government in the bloc agreed to it and got that through the Commission. So, you know, there's a lot of things you can say about how the British government isn't very democratic, and they're true and they're important points to make. Actually, we want to overthrow the British government. But all of them apply even more so to the EU and how it works. And I think those sort of four things, really, about how the EU has been the enforcer of austerity and neoliberalism. It's been the enforcer of immigration controls that have had an absolutely devastating effect in the Mediterranean. It's part of superpower competition, and it's fundamentally unreformable and undemocratic. I think if we look at it in those terms, it's quite stark. It could be a left-wing case for exit. Of course, that's not how the debate has been played out. And I think there's two sort of main things that come up as saying, well, you have to vote Remain despite all this, because that's not really what it's about. And one is saying that the EU may not be perfect, but on some level, it's about people coming together across borders in different countries. And that's got to be a good thing, hasn't it? And, you know, maybe it does it in the wrong way and we should try and reform it, but that's basically good. And the other is that the EU may have many problems, but actually it's defending us from something even worse. And that if you get rid of the EU, that what you're going to have is an even worse version of the Tory party or of UKIP, who will be off the leash to be far worse than they have been so far. And so I'm going to address some of those things. First of all, I think people coming together across borders is absolutely what we have to be for as socialists. I think internationalism is one of the most important things. But I don't think that's what the EU is. First of all, it's an alliance between states, between governments, not people. And, you know, they can have very opposite interests. There's a meme that's been going around social media promoting Remain that's been infuriating me. I don't know if people have seen it. The guy in the Green Party in Brighton holding up a placard saying, I want to stay in the EU because I don't want to be stuck on a tiny island with the Tories. Well, yeah, our government are our enemies, absolutely. But who do you think the rest of the EU is made up with? You know, the German government, it's the Tories. In France, for most of the period of the EU, it's been Tories in government. They could return to office next year. In the meantime, you have a Social Democrat who, on the EU's advice, is pushing through a tax on workers' rights and enforcing them with water cannons and rubber bullets. You know, and in a, you know, it's not that we're alone with the Tories either, by the way. As in all these countries, there is opposition, there is a fight back. But the European Union itself has always been a project of governments and states working very much with business, and with those sort of pro-business policies I outlined earlier, they've always been part of the aim. I mean, the first step towards it, the first treaty on the step towards European integration was bringing together and coordinating the coal and steel strategic industries. And so it's always been about big business and big governments. That's not quite the same. And the other thing is, it's a very limited type of internationalism that stops at the edge of Europe. It's a sort of arbitrary place to think, if you think about it. If I want to be, you know, not divided from French people or Germans or Spanish people, which of course I don't, why do I want to be cut off from Africans and from people in Asia and that? And actually, the more you look at the EU on a global scale, the more you see that actually it's not about bringing people together at all. It's been a very divisive thing. I mean, I think if you look at the period from the Second World War through to the end of the 20th century, the period of the EU coming together, and in particular the early stages where it was put in motion, what are the two big things that mark global politics in that era? Well, one is the Cold War, where suddenly you have a rivalry between two giant superpowers, the US and its allies, and Russia and its allies. And next to that, Germany or Britain or Italy, they're quite small. And the idea of being able to compete on that scale and be part of it, you need to club together. And in particular, this was always a project that was very much aligned to the US and the West, and how you know, the US part funded the initial process and very strongly lobbied for it, saying that we need a bulwark against the USSR, we need to make sure Europe stays with the West, and that means, you know, it holds together. And in practice, you know, the thing with Ukraine is one example, but actually EU expansion has always been explicitly tied to NATO expansion. New EU members, they have to join NATO, they have to sign a security agreement saying that they'll cooperate militarily with other forces, with other countries' forces, and it's always had that element of superpower competition. So far from, you know, people talk about, oh, it's brought peace, hasn't it, by getting rid of the antagonism between nations, but it hasn't got rid of that antagonism. It's projected it onto a world scale where it's far more dangerous, really. The other big change of that time was decolonisation. At the end of the Second World War, Britain ruled India, most of Africa was ruled by some European nation or another. You know, there was colonies all over, and fortunately they won their freedom, sometimes from very heroic struggles from the peoples of those countries against the European superpowers, which, by the way, you know, when they talk about we're brought together by our European values, democracy, human rights and that. Tell that to the Haitian revolutionaries, you know, tell that to the Algerians who fought France, tell that to the Indians who fought the British Raj. That's absolutely not the case. But anyway, that shift then also changes the positions of those countries. You know, you think after the Suez Crisis, when Britain's ruling class really have to start thinking, we're no longer this great empire that once ruled the place. What does that mean for us? And of course, there's always tensions over that, but in general, most of the ruling class in Britain and to an even greater extent in France and Germany and other countries have said, if we're going to have that influence now, then we can't do it alone. And so the EU functions as a diplomatic bloc, not just in everyone united, a diplomatic bloc against other parts of the world. I was on the European Commission website this morning and sort of proudly announces one of our key priorities is opening up markets for European businesses. And that means essentially the things that people hate the IMF and the World Bank for. It means going and making your demands as a big, powerful operation to other countries that say you can't restrict anything we want to do in your country. You can't have price controls. You can't, you know, stop private sector competition in this nationalised thing. You can't control the things that we're trying to sell or anything like that. And the consequences have been quite devastating. I mean, if you look at a lot of the people who are trying to flee Africa at the moment in sub-Saharan nations, and I don't want to say Africa is a country, by the way, but there are 18 different countries where what I'm about to say applies. A lot of, and they're dismissed as, oh, they're not proper refugees, they're economic migrants. Of course, people have many different reasons for fleeing. But one big problem in large parts of coastal African nations is that fisheries have collapsed and communities that depended on fishing, those fish have all gone away. Well, a big factor for that is since the 1970s, the EU and its predecessor, the European Community Single Market, went and bought market access to the waters of 18 African countries. And that means that as, you know, cod stocks were depleted in the North Sea, as overfishing took its toll in the seas around Europe, they're able to go down and do the same elsewhere. You talk about the common agricultural policy that subsidises farming in Europe in order to make sure that Europe has a better position against other regions worldwide. And it's blamed, you know, by all kinds of development charities. It's an uncontroversial thing to say that this has had a devastating effect on smallholding farming and the peasantry in vast swathes of Africa, Asia and Latin America. People who've gone from being farmers to being in debt or unemployed and you know, put more food in control of big businesses that's kicked in when there've been big famines. And so I think internationalism isn't really something you can say about it, in truth. And then within Europe, for me, socialist internationalism has to be that when workers are in struggle, our struggle knows no borders, and we line up with people in struggle. But if you look at any of the big workers' struggles that have been in Europe since the foundation of the EU has always been on the wrong side, and that's because it's structured to be so. And then the question comes of, does it then protect us from something worse? Would leaving the EU mean that we go from a frying pan to a fire that's even worse? Well, I think the idea that the EU is holding the Tory party back is what you often hear, that you'd get a turbocharged Tory party. I think it should give us pause for thought that the fact that the vast majority of the leaders of the Tory party, including all but three or four of the cabinet, are very strongly on the Remain side. They're that for a reason. The Tories have recently passed an attack on workers' rights, the trade union bill. The EU didn't do anything to stop them. A lot of the rights that it's given credit for are simply nothing to do with the EU as well, by the way. I mean, maternity leave in Britain, for example, is nearly four times the EU minimum. What rights we have are generally ones we've won through struggle. Very small amount came through the EU harmonisation at first, you know, where some countries had different rights as they joined, and there was an attempt to sort of harmonise what the minimums were. But that's, A, was always a very small part of it, and two, was a very long time ago. And now if you look at the recommendations the EU Commission, the European Commission issues to member states, they're all cuts, 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 privatisations, attacks on workers' rights. That's what it's calling for. And it's also the case, by the way, that anything that is on the statute books now will still be if Britain leaves the EU. You know, it would take a new law to repeal them. It's nothing would follow automatically from an exit. But so it hasn't held the Tories back from any of the things they've done so far. And the sort of things they want to do, the sort of things the EU is pushing anyway. And I think a lot of the argument ends up coming down on this idea that David Cameron actually, he's bad, but he's not been that bad. You know, that compared to Boris Johnson and Ian Duncan Smith and Michael Gove, Cameron's actually a softer option. I don't see any evidence for this at all. I think Boris Johnson is awful in exactly the same way as David Cameron is awful. I think they're right-wing, rich racists from the Bullingdon Club who went round smashing things up and burning £50 notes in front of homeless people and have then pursued that philosophy in government. But they've already been doing that as David Cameron's government. And I think it's absolutely nauseating when you see Sadiq Khan or you see Caroline Lucas from the Green Party and Harriet Harman standing on platforms with David Cameron. Like, I'm sorry, that's not helpful. And I think in general, there's a section of the left that says, in an ideal world, of course we'd vote against the EU. If we had a Labour government that was trying to do progressive things and the EU was blocking it, let's have a referendum then. But we've not, so we'd best not, because it'll just give a victory to UKIP, to Boris Johnson, and to all the right. I don't think that's true. I think, first of all, the Tory party is clearly in a horrible situation from its point of view that keeps getting worse. I mean, this referendum isn't one David Cameron wanted to have. It was because the row on Europe kept getting up, coming up, kept getting in the way, and he needed to unite the party behind him to go on the offensive. Actually, they've been in shambles, haven't they? I mean, you know, it will be a tragedy if the BMA signs up to Jeremy Hunt's rotten deal in the NHS, but actually he's not exactly fought them like a lion, has he? He's been left on his own in front of the junior doctors strike looking a shambles. Same with Nicky Morgan in the teachers campaign. She's had to make any number of U-turns and regroupments. Ian Duncan Smith leaving, since that, welfare cuts had been the sort of central theme of both the last government and the plans for this government. Now they don't know what they're doing. They barely talk about it, and when they do, it's a different thing each time. They're in a shambles. Now if that ends, as it probably would with a Remain vote, with a Leave vote, with David Cameron having to resign, you might well get Boris Johnson, you might not. I don't have a crystal ball. I think what you would have on the way of getting there is an absolutely bitter leadership contest, a sense of having been humiliated and failed by your internal divides. As I said at the beginning, how you reunite as a cabinet after all that, I don't know. I think the likelihood is we get a weak Tory government. And the person most likely to benefit from that isn't Nigel Farage, it's Jeremy Corbyn, in truth. Now, none of that's automatic, but the stage isn't actually that dire. And I think the case you often get is for that argument is, at the same time, utopian optimism and dire pessimism. Pessimism in the sense that winning anything in Britain is impossible. In Britain, we're alone with the Tories and they'll be on the rampage. But utopian in the sense that while we can't win reform by defeating one government, we can win it by defeating 27 governments and the bureaucracy that holds them together. As Frankie Boyle put it in The Guardian, the left that hasn't been able to convince people at local elections that it can be trusted to take the bins out thinks it can win its arguments against a vast bureaucracy partly composed of fascists. You know, there's an unrealism there. And I think since so much of the campaign has revolved around sowing panic, if we leave the EU, all kinds of dreadful things will happen. We should have some perspective. I think life will go on whichever way it goes. But in truth, how we vote does have consequences. And if you look at the moment, the EU leaders are very worried about the way things are going. The polls in a number of countries suggest that either large minorities, or in some cases outright majorities, people are coming out against the EU. What happens in Britain could have a big knock-on effect everywhere else. And if there's a vote to remain, that takes the pressure right off them, I think. Not forever, but backs off. And if you look at what they've had to do to try and deal with that, in Greece, they rushed through the latest round of negotiations. They were very, very afraid of being in the place of holding a gun to the Greek government's head again, demanding more privatisation, at the same time as Britain voted. they put off, they were going to fine the Spanish and Portuguese state several billion euros for not having making cuts fast enough. They postponed that until after both the British referendum and the Spanish election. Some of the targets they've been setting to France on austerity that it's been meeting, that they're easing up on as well. Of course, this is all for different reasons, but these are all things, they're all connected. The EU is trying to do things. Similarly, its deal with Turkey, by the way, to deport Syrian refugees from Greece, that's been struggling through legal obstacles. They wanted to both do this quickly and legally, and it wasn't possible. Now the Turkish government's getting cold feet. It will be much, they'll have much more of a mandate to go back and do that if Britain stays in, if the EU is bigger, if the country that was first to start giving money to Turkey for this deal stays in, than if they leave. So it has consequences. And the truth is, with or without the EU, we'll be faced with a set of governments in Britain and across Europe that represent the interests of the ruling class and are willing to be utterly vicious, to whip up racism and to attack workers. That's all true. The question is, will they be stronger or weaker in doing that without the EU? And I think from that the verdict is clear, that if the whole Tory cabinet, the whole Labour right, almost the entirety of big business in Britain, the Pentagon, the army, the police chief, if all of those are saying we have to stay in the EU, I think we have to be clear in saying we're better off without it.